The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into the August issue of Our State Magazine, which is entitled The Lunch Break, and features articles about favorite lunch spots around the state. Our first article is Bacon Lettuce Tradition. At a gas station turned grill, town and gown gather to make memories, collect stories, and build friendships over Chapel Hill's signature sandwich. And on the facing page is a picture of this phenomenal sandwich. The BLT, available as a single, double, or triple, is the signature sandwich at Merritt's Grill, embodying the motto of former co-owner Robin Britt. A great lunch at a great value with a kind word. Bacon, lettuce, tomato. Together they make up a tiny slice of the South. Slather mayonnaise on two pieces of bread. Dust with a shake each of salt and pepper, and call it lunch. A classic BLT. But that's not a Merritt's BLT. Let's break it down. The bacon comes from a North Carolina farm, sizzled to perfection. The tomatoes are as big as baseballs, plucked ripe red from in and around North Carolina. The lettuce, trucked in directly from farms in California and Texas, is separated by a five-person team into single leaves the size of dessert plates. In the kitchen, the lettuce and tomatoes are arranged like playing cards on serving trays, then delivered a few steps away to two people tasked with creating four kinds of BLTs. Those BLTs can tip the scales. The baby BLT is the lightest, weighing in at a half pound. But the triple BLT? That's one daunting skyscraper of a sandwich. It comes with a warning on the menu, not for the faint of heart. A full 1 pound of bacon with four layers of lettuce and tomato. It even has its own T-shirt, displayed beside the cash register. Sourdough, bacon, 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 lettuce, tomato, sourdough. That says everything. That is a Merritt's BLT. The Merritt's BLT is the go-to sandwich of Chapel Hill, crafted in a spot as cherished as the old well. Restaurants and coffee shops along Franklin Street may come and go, yet 5 minutes south of UNC's campus, Merritt's remains as it always was, a place of memories and memories that thrum the heart. The small white building is a former gas station that opened in 1929. Back then, Orange County was more country than cosmopolitan, and the college town of Chapel Hill seemed far away. Not anymore. At lunch, customers young and old play their own version of Frogger as they stop, start, and stop again before speed walking or jogging across three lanes of traffic on South Columbia Street. When they reach Merritt's, they step into a time capsule that represents, through smell and touch, sight and sound, the best of Chapel Hill in North Carolina. Songs by James Taylor spill from a loudspeaker. Cheer wine comes in bottles. Carolina Blue is eye candy everywhere. The scent of wood-smoked bacon hangs over the back parking lot like a strong perfume. Customers start conversations with strangers and share lunch with people they just met. They take photos of their surroundings and hear thank yous after someone delivers a menu or holds open the restaurant's only door. If they're lucky, they'll see someone from the storied fields and courts of UNC. Soccer star Mia Hamm. Basketball guard Marcus Ginyard, football coach Mack Brown, or quarterback Drake May, now starting for the New England Patriots. May comes in with his family, obliges anyone who asks for a selfie, and sits at one of the 20 or so tables walled by a grove of bamboo out back. The BLTs, wrapped in white paper and delivered in brown bags, are the real lunchtime draw. But so are the chances to make memories, hear stories, and see snapshots of everyday Chapel Hill every few feet. First, the stories. UNC basketball coach Dean Smith supposedly played poker downstairs. A young James Taylor joined his brother Livingston and played acoustic for free on a small stage in front of the bamboo grove. Eben Merritt, who owned the place when it was a gas station, was also a heavy equipment operator who dug out the footings to support the structure that became Keenan Stadium in 1927. And, of course, there's the storied triple BLT, Merritt's Edible Star. Who orders those? 14-year-old boys, Paula Toogood says, they can knock out a triple. Paula, her husband John, and their 28-year-old son are the third family to own Merritt's. And yes, she's seen her share of teenagers tackling the triple BLT like some rite of passage. CJ has witnessed customers, fresh off a plane, walk in with luggage still in their hands and wax poetic about a Merritt's BLT before ordering one more. And of course, he remembers the guy who rushed in wearing a patient wristband from the local hospital. I asked him, does your doctor know you're here? And he told me, no, I want to enjoy life, and this is the place to do it. CJ knows the draw. It's the bacon, man. Years ago, John Toogood walked into Merritt's for a sandwich and had an epiphany. We could sell Merritt's our bread. He and Paula, who met us at undergrads at Penn State, owned the bread shop in Pittsburgh and knew they could offer Merritt's at least 8 different types of bread. John introduced himself to Robin Britt, who took over Merritt's in 91 with her husband, Bob. Robin invited him down 11 steps behind the cash register to the Britt's office. Situated behind the dugout bays where Merritt could once stand upright and work on cars. Can we pray before we start? Robin asked. That one meeting closed the sale. For more than 15 years, John and Paula supplied bread to Merritt's. After Robin died in April 2014 at age 61, 9 months after being diagnosed with cancer, her presence at Merritt's never went away. Just look and listen. In the window, written in pink chalk in the black base of a serving tray, is her favorite phrase, "You are loved." Robin created the Merritt's BLT for her husband. For years, she made him a BLT for lunch. When people asked her about Merritt's delectable signature, she would tell them the story of what she called the love sandwich. She was the juice behind Merritt's, John says today. The reputation she built is the reason we've had success. The Brits first ran Merritt's as a convenience store with a grill. In 2008, to weather the Great Recession, they created a menu full of Southern staples, from banana pudding to a fried bologna sandwich. Merritt's thrived. Robin made that happen, but not just for food. People will come in and say, I knew her, or we talked to her all the time, John said. She was a special lady. She really cared for people. Angel Juarez, Merritt's kitchen manager, can attest to that. His mom used to work in the kitchen. And she told him stories of Robin's graciousness. If someone in the kitchen was financially strapped, she would loan them money and say, when you can, pay it back. Juarez knew her as Miss Robin. She would be ecstatic with what Merritt's has become, she says. She had a vision of what it would be, and this, it's definitely this. In September 2021, the Toogoods bought Merritt's. John and Paula needed their son's help, and CJ discovered a new passion. In 2019, he'd graduated with a finance degree from Elon University. He'd earned All-American honors as an offensive tackle for the Phoenix and signed as a free agent with the Baltimore Ravens. His pro football career didn't last, and he left looking for a brand new direction in his life. He found it at Merritt's. He huddled with his parents and applied his business acumen and the discipline he learned from the gridiron. Together, they gave Merritt's a 21st century upgrade that relieved the frustration felt by customers who used to wait anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour for a BLT. The Toogoods instituted technology that eliminated the drag of paper tickets. They bought new equipment, doubled the staff, upgraded both parking lots, and covered the seating area out front with large umbrellas. Their improvements have made Merritt's more comfortable and created a process that delivers BLTs within minutes during any lunch rush. Even with all those updates, the Toogoods knew what they could never change, the Southern casual vibe that has made Merritt's a Chapel Hill institution, and the BLT that the Raleigh News and Observer named one of the 25 tastes that define North Carolina. It's a big responsibility, a weight on our shoulders, but it's a good thing to have, CJ says. Merritt's is not ours. It's everybody's, and we have to keep it that way. The way people remember it so they can have more memories. From any spot at Merritt's, the allure unspools in minutes. Take this lunch. A trio of tourists speaking Japanese take selfies beside Merritt's red 1964 pickup truck, its trunk bed filled with flowers. Wave after wave of 20-somethings dressed in Carolina blue pours in. At a table sits an older couple dressed in Tar Heel swag from the shoulder to the shin. When they retired and moved to Chapel Hill a few years ago, their daughter, a 2015 UNC grad, told them they needed to eat at Merritt's. So they do, every week. They order much from the menu, but what sold them at first? It's simple. Bacon, lettuce, tomato. Merritt's Grill is located at 1009 South Columbia Street in Chapel Hill, and you can check out their website at merrittsblt.com. Here's a little extra information here, a little side article. The BLT breakdown. The famous BLT at Merritt's Grill is no lightweight sandwich. When you consider that a pound equals 16 ounces, each BLT carries a culinary heft that's legendary in North Carolina. A single weighs 11.5 ounces, a double weighs 15.7 ounces, and a triple weighs 20.2 ounces. Even the baby BLT, weighing in at 8.2 ounces, or half a pound, is plenty heavy. How does that heaviness happen? Well, the baby BLT has one leaf of lettuce, two slices of tomato, and four pieces of bacon. A single has two leaves of lettuce, four slices of tomato, and seven pieces of bacon. The double has three leaves of lettuce, six slices of tomato, and nine pieces of bacon. And the triple comes in with four leaves of lettuce, eight slices of tomato, and 12 pieces of bacon. How about that? Our next article is entitled Paper Town's Porch. At a stately Queen Anne in downtown Canton, diners enjoy lunchtime favorites among pieces of the town's enduring history, including the house itself. Graceful curves and turrets and a white-pillared front porch face Canton's main street. The brick Queen Anne they belong to, now known as the popular lunch spot, Southern Porch Kitchen and Drink, has been a landmark in the mountain town since the late 19th century. Just a few minutes' walk from Pigeon River, the elegant establishment has had many lives. It was first built as a private home in 1876. Then in 1910, it was purchased by a businessman who expanded it into the Imperial Hotel to capitalize on the opening of the nearby Champion Fiber Company paper mill. The hotel became intimately linked with the mill. It ran electricity from Champion's generator and hosted its executives and their guests. The Imperial was celebrated in the press as one of the state's best $2 hotels, a high compliment at the time. Today, 2 years after the mill's closure brought more than a century of Canton papermaking to an end, artifacts of that time boom. A waitress's starched white apron, an elegant grandfather clock, welcome diners into Southern Porch, which has called the building home since 2016. The restaurant's patio occupies a space that was once an adjoining drugstore, its tiny floor tiles still intact. In the main dining room, you can see, embedded in the dark wood boards, a trapdoor to a Prohibition-era speakeasy. Preserving that prosperous paper town history matters to co-owners Michaela and Nathan Lowe, who grew up in the region and know what it means to the people of Canton. Before the mill closed in 2023, it employed more than 1,000 of the town's 4,000 residents. Every lunchtime saw a parade of mill workers walking to Southern Porch, where they can enjoy a meal and air conditioning. We'd see some guys every day. And then they'd be back with their families at night, Michaela recalls, looking around the sunny, brick-walled front room. Even now, we still have regulars. You'll take their order, and then they're up and walking around talking to everyone they know. But we're seeing new faces, too. On this day, there's a couple in hiking gear sharing collard bacon dip. There's a girl enjoying a heap of onion rings with her mother and grandmother. A table of men in T-shirts and jeans are laughing and catching up over Southern Porch's best-selling burgers. Nathan, who's also the chef, has emerged from the kitchen to chat with the local about an upcoming community fundraiser. It's a snapshot of Canton and Southern Porch are today and what they might become in the years ahead. The Loths share deep roots in Haywood County. Michaela grew up as the daughter of a local Christmas tree and produce farmer. Nathan graduated from nearby Tuscola High School in Waynesville, Canton's rival. The couple met after they graduated from Western Carolina University. After they married, Nathan was gaining experience at the local bistro when the owners of the previous restaurant in the Southern Porch space approached them. It was an opportunity for Nathan to make his dream of opening a restaurant come true. We wanted Southern Porch to be a place where people could gather, whether they were just coming off of their shift at the mill or heading to their kids' baseball game, he says. With the help of Michaela's mother and stepfather, who have extensive restaurant resumes themselves, the Lowe's opened Southern Porch with a menu of North Carolina classics like fried yard bird and tomato sliders. Yes, they use Duke's mayo, incorporating local ingredients whenever they can. The couple celebrates the flavors of the region through their own family favorites. Carrie's Chicken and Wood Chips is named for one of their daughters. The sweet Thai chili wing sauce is named for their late son, Thai. Come in for lunch and you might find their daughters, Carrie and Brindley, age 11 and 14, playing hostess and contributing to the family atmosphere that reflects this tight-knit town. In the late 1920s, a sterile brick facade was built around the Queen Anne Gym in an effort to expand and standardize the look of Main Street. In the 1990s, attorney and former Canton Mayor Pat Smathers and his wife Sherry bought the property, which sits across the street from his office, and restored the building to its former grace. When I was a little boy, there was just a straight up and down brick wall, Smathers said. I wanted to take that down and get back to the past. I've always been very proud of our town and our history, but I also wanted to build on that and move us towards success in the future. Now the building looks like it did during Canton's first boom, and Smathers believes that a new era of prosperity is on the way. The closure of the mill means that the notorious aroma of papermaking, a sulfurous smell associated with the chemical reactions used in pulping wood chips, no longer lingers in the air. A 2-year demolition process has begun at the mill site, with plans for its reinvention into both residential and commercial properties. Smathers plans to turn the former Imperial guest rooms above Southern Porch into a boutique hotel, and he is completing a wine bar and event space in the old post office next door. Southern Porch employee Emery Wright shares Smathers' hope that good times lie ahead. As the child of a mill employee, she's known many of the regulars all her life before the mill closed. It would be a great way to see my dad and a table of his friends when I was working lunch, she says. They still come in, but new faces appear at her tables, too. 4 generations of my family worked in the mill, but I think that even though Canton is changing, we can hold on to our history and our spirit. As Wright slides plates of griddled cornbread and peanut butter pie onto tables with a warm smile, she embodies the spirit of Canton and Southern Porch, resilient, welcoming, and always looking ahead. Southern Porch Kitchen is Drink is located on Main Street in Canton, North Carolina, and they have a website, southern-porch.com. Moving on to the next article, entitled Rolling Refreshment. During the first half of the 20th century, workers in North Carolina's textile mills found respite in dope wagons, mobile carts stocked with relief. Imagine working in a North Carolina cotton mill during the 1920s when factories dotted the state's landscape. The dry, earthy smell of cotton dust hangs heavy in the air. The large industrial contraptions that fill the plant, endless rows of spinning frames, weaving looms, winding machines, and more, roar to life, creating a constant hum in the mill. Women, teens, and sometimes even children stand close by the machines like sentries. There's no air conditioning, no cafeteria, and in most cases, no sympathy. You're hot, tired, dirty, hungry, and thirsty. The noise is oppressive as well. If you don't have a headache, there's a good chance you'll have one soon. Even worse, you're barely halfway through your 12-hour shift, but you don't dare leave your post because, well, it's your post. You need the job no matter how tough it is. The good news is the most popular man in the building, the dope wagon pusher, is headed your way, steering his cart of goods from one machine to the next. No, he's not that kind of dope pusher. But to an overheated, physically drained mill worker, his products, ice-cold drinks known as dopes, an assortment of sandwiches and pick-me-up snacks, all selling for a nickel or a dime apiece, sure are addictive. That's what cotton mills were like during the textile industry's heyday, when workers labored through grueling shifts with limited breaks. The dope wagon was an oasis in a desert of humidity and cotton dust. It doesn't seem like much now, but prior to the dope wagons, you were on your own for nourishment during those 12-hour shifts, says Kent Hester, a Gaston County Museum of Art and History guide who specializes in textile history. They were part of a movement to improve the worker experience in the mills. Dope wagons were essentially mobile concession stands that brought refreshments directly to workers. The long rectangular carts were narrow enough to navigate the 24 to 36-inch aisles between the endless rows of machinery. They were mounted on sturdy tires, sometimes ones from an old Model A or Model T automobiles or motorcycles, for easier pushing. When the wagons were completely full, Hester says, they could easily weigh 700 to 1,000 pounds or more. That's why you didn't see any women pushing dope wagons through the mills. Dope wagons were typically handmade and fashioned with numerous drawers and cubbies that stashed everything from sandwiches, crackers, moon pies, and candy bars to chewing tobacco. More importantly, every dope wagon had a compartment lined with tin or some other metal where ice could be stored to keep drinks like Pepsi, Cheerwine, and Orange and Grape Knee-High cold all day. It's Coca-Cola, however, that is believed to have given dope wagons their name. Coke had small amounts of cocaine in it, which even back then was called dope, Hester explained. Even after 1929, when cocaine was outlawed and removed from Coca-Cola, people still called any cold, caffeinated soft drinks dopes. You wouldn't ask for a Coke, you'd ask for a dope. While most historians believe that's where the term originated, Hester points out that there's a second, less popular theory. In hot, dirty, loud mill, people would often get headaches, so a common product the dope wagon sold were headache powders, such as Goodies, BC, and Standback, he says. They were a kind of dope, and people think that's where the dope wagons got their name. According to Hester, dope wagons were not exclusive to textile mills, but that's where they were introduced in the early 1910s, where they were mostly found for decades. The carts were especially prominent in Gaston County, which had more than 100 textile mills in the 1920s, including the behemoth Loray Mill, a plant with some 3,500 workers at its height, and mills across the state, Clinchfield Mill in Marion, Cannon Mills in Kannapolis, Burlington Industries in Alamance County, Pilot Mill in Raleigh, all likely had dope wagon pushers. While there are respite for employees, the carts primarily benefited the mills. They were facing labor shortages due to low wages and poor working conditions. The mills had to think of ways to attract and keep employees, such as better equipment and sometimes a little better pay, Hester says. One amenity that came about was the introduction of the dope wagon. Some companies paid an employee to push the dope wagon through the mill two or three times per shift, while others contracted with outside vendors, say a local grocery store owner who already had the merchandise in stock. And owners didn't have to provide a lunch break because dope wagons could come to workers on the job. After the start of the Korean War, dope wagons gradually began to disappear. Companies replaced the wagons with vending machines or small cantinas, Hester says. By the 1970s, there were still a few dope wagons around, but most of the mills had switched over to coin-operated vending machines, and eventually all of them did. Mention dope wagons today, and most people will respond with a blank stare. But a century ago, they were as indispensable as the mills themselves. We'll take a quick detour from the lunch articles to one of the newer areas of the magazine entitled North Carolina Noted. listening to music that shapes our state's history, culture, and people. And this one is entitled Old Time Picker. In the High Country, a guitarist is carried on the region's musical identity by teaching students the rich traditions of Appalachian music for five decades. It was the sound and feel of tires traversing a curvy dirt road deep in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Bumpy, scratchy, exhilarating, Rhonda Gouge couldn't get enough of the guitar boogie. Arthur Smith's chugging 12-bar blues instrumental with a hillbilly twang. Every morning before school, she turned into Carolina Calling, the country music variety show that Smith taped out of WBTV in Charlotte. Rhonda watched the show on the little TV set in her family's home in the tiny mountain community of Ledger. Every morning she was awed. She wanted to play the guitar just like Smith, and that's exactly what she ended up doing. I wanted to learn more about Rhonda, the 70-year-old woman who lives in North Carolina's High Country, where she spent a lifetime preserving Appalachian music traditions and teaching generations of young people how to play in older styles. Maybe, she thought, I thought, she might agree to teach an old dog like me a few new tricks. These days, Rhonda not only performs bluegrass and old-time mountain hymns at churches and events across Mitchell County, but she also enjoys putting the spotlight on her five decades of students, many of whom, she says, have grown up to surpass her own abilities. She's being modest, of course. Sitting in the home studio in Ledger that she calls the Pickin' Parlor, she's trading guitar licks on her Martin D-16 with former students Sam McKitty and Catherine Kuhn. Their vocal harmonies on standards like I'm Winging My Way Back Home and Blessed Jesus Hold My Hand blend like a band of angels. Rhonda's been all around music all her life. Her mother was a shape note singer at Bear Creek Baptist Church nearby in Bakersville, and family friend Oscar Red Wilson was well known in the region for old-time fiddle tunes. He was her mentor, and under his tutelage, Rhonda learned not only the guitar, but also the fiddle, mandolin, banjo, and bass. For years after high school, she performed occasionally with Wilson's band, the Tow River Valley Boys. But she always longed for more. Rhonda wanted to learn everything she could about the music that stretches back generations in her own bloodline. Music that fueled the talents of so many of her heroes, Smith, Wilson, Elizabeth Cotton of Carrboro, and Doc Watson of Deep Gap. So she returned to school as an adult, earning her master's degree in Appalachian Studies at Appalachian State University. When Rhonda pulls a tattered copy of the Redback Hymnal from a nearby overstuffed bookshelf and demonstrates the way a shape note hymn is sung, she knows what she's talking about. She explains how the shapes revealed which notes and what pitch to sing into mountain vocalists who couldn't read conventional sheet music. After hours of sitting around the Pickin' Parlor with Rhonda, listening to her trio perform an encyclopedia of traditional mountain hymns and other tunes, Goodbye World, Goodbye, and When You and I Were Young, Maggie, Wildwood Flower, Summertime, the others eventually bid adieu. The room becomes silent for the first time all day. Rhonda looks up from her chair. So, you want to learn a little fingerstyle picking, she asks. From a master player like Rhonda, it's the moment I've been waiting for, and for another hour she kindly and patiently guides me and my fingers through a step-by-step lesson on how to pick Elizabeth Cotton's classic song, Freight Train. Maybe one day, if I practice hard enough, I'll learn to play guitar just like Rhonda Gouge. We've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine, but I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974, and they can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.